Live from the Regis Suites in Peoria, Arizona, you're listening to Get On To It, brought to you by the Breakthrough Thinking Broadcasting Network. I'm Dave Isaac, the host, alongside the star of the show, Don Williams. Don, welcome.
Hello, and welcome to Get On To It. Today's topic is willingness for change or willingness to change. It's very important when you go through life and you deal with things that you're not necessarily comfortable with to understand that overcoming that difficulty for change is really going to push you through. Most of us fear what we don't understand. Today we have a fantastically interesting guest named John Steller. He was originally a broadcast journalist with NBC, and he worked as a public relations professional since 1992. He's worked around in and around the media since graduating from Reynolds School of Journalism at the University of Nevada, Reno. John, you have quite the interesting background, from what I understand, with regards to how you got to be doing PR work. If you could kind of give us that background and those changes that you recognized along the way and how you felt and was kind of experiencing those changes and what you've learned from being willing to go through those changes.
Oh, sure. Well, first of all, Don and Dave, thanks for having me on the show. It's a joy to speak with you both today.
Well, you're more than welcome. We're a big fan of yours, by the way.
hopefully you'll be saying that at the end of the hour. So thanks for the opportunity to share today. And so I'll just jump right in, Don. I think what you're referring to is the story that I told you about a month ago, that I was in college and very excited to become a journalist, and the role models for me were the Ted Koppels and the Peter Jennings of the world, what I would consider the broadcasters with a lot of integrity. I saw myself in that anchor desk, and I was excited, and my life was really lining up around that. And, of course, I was a, like, 24/7 news junkie, and my minor was political science, so I was just all over the media and politics, and it was a very exciting time coming up, and I was interning for NBC News my senior year of college, and they hired me right after college. So I was, really excited, thrilled, and everything looked good. And then, it's about 7 months after college. I'm in a mid-market NBC station in Reno, Nevada, where I finished college. And there was a night where I was producing the newscast. It would switch off between reporting and producing, and I was producing. And there was a murder on an Indian reservation that was close enough for me to get a camera out and back and lead with it for the 11 o'clock news. And this was before Fox News, so it was like 91. And so I looked as I let off the 11 o'clock newscast, and CBS and ABC local did not have this story about a murder on an Indian reservation. I did. And I literally stood on the desk cheering. I got the story, I led with it, the other two didn't. And I woke up the next morning. When I'd work those evening shifts, I'd get to sleep about 2 o'clock, so I was getting up the next morning, looked in the bathroom mirror, and I just thought, oh, my God, what is my life about? I've stood on my desk and cheered, and someone died. And this is not the first murder I'd reported on, and it had me wonder how many more murders and how many more horrible, horrific things I'd be reporting on before I got to my vision, which was the anchor desk.
So what you're saying, it sounds like you realize ratings is not the only thing in town.
Correct. And that, for me, how much of my soul was I willing to sell to have, what looked like my vision work out? And it was a very, it was a life-altering moment, and I knew in my gut what I needed to do, and what I needed to do was around the theme of the show. I needed to change, And the change that I saw was that I needed to leave the news business, which was crazy. It was completely opposite of whatever I, you know, thought in the past. But I just, the road between where I was at that point and where I wanted to be was just, it had looked long before, but it looked super long, and it looked like a complete sellout. And that by the time I got to the end of that road in that anchor desk, there wasn't going to be much left of me internally. I was just going to be this, like, kind of Teflon person.
Yeah, I hear you. You know, and you're blessed, by the way, John, that you came to that moment, you know, early in your life, because a lot of people go through life clueless about really what's important, what's not, and what type of legacy they want to leave in the world, and how to help people.
And one of the things that I mention to people is how much people put weight on the value of other people's input. So you had, over time, looked at that position that you were searching for and saw this as your personal goal. And sometimes we find out, if we're honest with ourselves, that something that we want isn't as pleasing a thing as we thought it would be once we receive it or come close to it. And that takes a lot of courage to be able to recognize what's going on. And some people have this fear problem with regards to investment. Oh, they've invested so much time, invested so much money, or whatever it is that they gave up to pursue something they thought is a value. When they got the reality check, they often dismiss it because of a fear that that means they're wrong in some way. And that's not necessarily the case. It's just a recognition of what they thought they wanted versus what it really is. And until you experience it, you just don't know. So what was the next evolution in this progression?
Well, and by the way, I just want to say that I gave the NBC affiliate a month's notice so they could make sure and fill the post. Mm. And every shift past that murder on the Indian reservation was agonizing. So I, you know, during that month, it was very clear that I made the right choice, as counterintuitive as it was. So what ended up being the next step for me is moving back to my native Southern California, and I wasn't sure what I'd do when I would come back. And on one of my two flights back to Southern California, I actually met my next boss, the general manager of the Hyatt Hotel on Sunset Boulevard, which used to be called the Riot House. It was where all the musicians in the 70s and 80s used to party and throw guitars and TV sets out windows.
Well, sort of like the Who. Or was that the Guess Who? The Who, I think.
Well, it was a virtual who's who of celebrities and entertainment that came to that hotel and just, you know, complete debauchery in the 70s and 80s. So it had that reputation. I got there in, it was late 91, and started as a restaurant manager because I'd had food and beverage experience. And jumped into that, and it was a smaller niche hotel, and they saw that, you know, I was young and had a strong back, and so they, you know, kept giving me promotions, and within a year I was the director of catering. So I was, you know, scheduling and planning all the parties and events at the hotel, and it was everything from, you know, bar mitzvahs to, I think the craziest event I ever planned and hosted was a bachelor party for Paul Stanley of the band Kiss.
Oh, wow.
That Gene Simmons was the host. And imagine having Gene Simmons, who's a really intense guy, in your face all night, about 30 guys, 10 strippers, a bartender and a server, and myself. It was a wild experience. So that was kind of the spectrum there. So, you know, for a guy in his mid-20s who, I had been married, but I was divorced and separated at that point, so I'm single, having this, you know, these interesting experiences, it's a lot of fun, and it turned out to be another career where I looked at the past, and it was going to be a long, long walk, and, you know, selling myself short again. So, for the first time ever, I I gave 2 weeks notice without a plan. I had never done that before because when I left Reno, I at least had a plan. And that was, you know, younger and single, mid-20s. I had stashed like 6 or 7 months worth of expenses.
John, let me interrupt you real quick. What was the point in time that you realized that, hey, this was also not the career for you? What was the one thing that, or two things that you realized, like, oh, wow, is that all there is? I mean, did something happen? Or did
I can give you one. I can definitely give you both one specific moment.
Yeah.
The specific moment was this. I mentioned that this particular hotel, the Hyatt on Sunset, which is now called the Andaz Hotel, and it's right in the heart of it, West Hollywood, next to Hollywood. There are what Hyatt Corporation calls FAM trips, and it's where workers from other hotels, usually managers and executives, come from around the country to experience a specific hotel. And they, Hyatt was making a sweep to Southern California, so our hotel was one of 5 or 6 hotels that was going to be visited by about 200 Hyatt managers and executives from around the country. And our hotel was on notice for weeks. We had all this preparation. Because of our hotel having a rooftop pool that overlooks the city, we were the spot where they were going to have kind of the big culinary event. Mm-hmm. And I worked a 28-hour day.
What? 28-hour day, and you said?
I worked a 28-hour day, and I had it was 29, but I took an hour break to drive home, to shower, and put on a new suit.
Wow.
And
that's commitment
and
there.
For those 28 hours, because we were a smaller hotel, I'm in a suit throwing down tables and putting out tablecloths and making sure everyone's in the right place. And I mean, it was very hands-on. And I saw in that 28-hour shift that this company was willing to, you know, work me to the bone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that wasn't for me. It's for, you know, it's okay for some people, but I just saw, you know, put in almost 2 years here. They appreciate me. However, I've just worked a 28-hour day.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God. You know, it's one thing to be a manager and have a salary and, you know, not punch a clock. But when I looked and, you know, a day or two after that, when I kind of recovered, I thought, wow, no.
Yeah.
this is not it either. And I've got skills that I can use.
Yeah. Now, John, you bring up a really good point here for all the listeners. A lot of people, especially in this time frame, that over the past several years with all the different economic woes and ups and downs, lefts and turns, they're in a flux. They go to school, they have this idea of what they want to do, and it doesn't seem like anything is patented to make sense like the way it once did. And here's a perfect example of your story saying, hey, it has always been that way. It hasn't been that way to that extreme that everybody goes through these changes when they reach these points of awareness for what they thought they wanted. And for you, this good example here with being in a managerial position, a lot of people think, oh man, I'm the manager, I don't have to work as much, and blah, 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 blah. And here's a perfect example of where you're the manager and you're working as much, if not more, than anybody else, and you're not getting any recognition for it, or at least not anything clear or close to what we would think you would be given what you're telling us. And you get this aha moment where you're like, whoa, this is what it is? I don't know if I want to stick around here, if I'm understanding you correctly.
Yeah, absolutely. And that day in particular, I kept thinking, wow, I would much rather be on the clock.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
But it's probably even more than that, though, right? I mean, it's not just the financial reward or the just unusual or maybe usual circumstances in that type of industry, but But I get the sense that there was a bigger purpose for you at a much grander level that would make a difference in the world.
Yes, absolutely. And I, you know, at that point, I thought my next calling was to write books about relationships. I considered myself, you know, an expert, which was, you know, in hindsight, it was ridiculous. I'd been married once for about a year. That didn't work. I wasn't in a relationship at the time. As I look back, I mean, it was laughable, but, you know, it was what I was thinking at the time, so I don't, it's all perfect. And what ended up happening was that second big change in my life where I had the realization that, you know, if I stayed in that job in the hotel industry, for me, it was going to kill off my soul, which would, you know, not be good over time. And so I really needed to move on. And so for the first time ever, I gave 2 weeks' notice without any kind of a plan. My grandmother had, maternal grandmother died at the time, so it actually freed me up to go to Washington State and be with my grandfather a week or so after the funeral, which I find is often a time where the grieving really, like people really hit a wall of grief. And I got to be with my grandfather, and I helped him drive he and my grandmother's motorhome from Washington State to Southern California, where it needed to be and where he actually needed to be, surrounded by family. So I got to have that experience. And then within a week or so after that, I thought, okay, now what? I'm really feeling bored. You know, I'm not feeling useful. And a friend's wife owned a small PR firm in Toluca Lake, California, and they needed help on reception for a couple weeks. And so I went and I, you know, just pitched in, and I wasn't even worried about, you know, a paycheck at that point. I just wanted to help them out and, you know, have a different experience. And what I found out within 2 weeks, but I think I actually knew within hours of being in that spot that that's where I was going to be, to use up all my gifts in the area of communication with media, telling company stories, attracting attention for entrepreneurs and emerging companies, which I've been doing for the past 22 years. But it took those couple of big changes to get to this point. And back to Don's point of the willingness, you know, up with this I shall no longer put is an expression I've heard people say. And I got to those places.
Well, let's take a quick break right now. When we come back, I want to ask you a question. I heard that there's a client of yours that branded you the unpublicist. Does that sound familiar? So when we come back from the break, I'm real curious about what that means. I think I have an idea, and I think it's a really cool thing. But let's let you explain it. And this is Get On To It, starring Don Williams. I'm Dave Isaac. Our special guest, John Steller, calling in from, I think you're in Los Angeles, aren't you?
Studio City, California.
Studio City. Oh, yes. I grew up in the San Fernando Valley, and so I know where that is, definitely. And we'll be right back.
We chased our pleasures. You know, the day destroys the night. Night divides the day.
And welcome back to Get On To It, brought to you by the Breakthrough Thinking Broadcasting Network. I'm Dave Isaac, alongside the star of the show, Don Williams, and special guest, John Steller, who's been called the unpublicist. A nice branding, I think. John, where'd that come from?
Well, from a client. Her name is Juliet Fassett, and for 3 or 4 years, she had a company called Mix Incorporated, and Mix was all about bringing cool products from overseas to America and introducing people to, you know, cool new things. And she, at that time, she was importing a lot of cell phone and laptop related cases. That was kind of her main thing. And we had a really cool relationship. We'd met in a program called the Entrepreneurial Edge, and Juliet was a very savvy businesswoman who had worked for a number of corporations before going out on her own, and so she knew about public relations. She'd worked with other PR teams and publicists, and she just really liked the personal approach that myself and our company brings. and it was different than any experience she had had before. And in one phone conversation, she said, "You're the unpublicist, John. You're just not like anyone else I know. I appreciate that, and I bet there are other people that do as well." And just to add a little bit more onto that, I think it was because that I would be the unpublicist with clients then and now, because when I was in journalism school, I was in broadcast journalism special, you know, that was my special area, my focus. And public relations people were those folks at the other end of the hall. I have no idea what they're doing. I'm not even sure they're journalists. And so and that might sound kind of negative. I think what it was that I didn't have a picture of what a PR person should look like or do, and I was willing to have my own version of that. And because I just hadn't met many PR people that I really resonated with, yet I was very capable of getting messages out to the media, and partly because, trained as a journalist, I knew how to package a story for a reporter or producer so that their work would be much easier and they could just receive it and either, you know, be interested and run with it or not, you know, and if they weren't, they wouldn't be insulted and they'd keep taking my calls. So that was how the unpublicist came around, and I still share that today, and I think most people do appreciate it.
There's no doubt, and then what it reminds me of is, first of all, it's a high-end compliment to you, very high-end, but it also reminds me of if someone calls a phenomenal salesperson a non-salesperson, that's a high-end compliment. In other words, it's just high-end communication, serving the person that might be interested in the product, but never forcing it. So it's a unique position to, at a very high level of just of service to others, and if it doesn't work, you don't push it. You just say, hey, then this isn't right for you. And that's the best type of salespeople. They're really called unsalespeople.
Yeah, and one of the things that I've explained to people, John, is that when it comes to success, a lot of it has to do with the value you bring to the experience. And you're bringing this unique set of values and skills. And through your first two stories that you were giving us earlier, it shows how you can use what you have and adapt, and you're flexible. And this is one of the things that some people will refer to on a long-term view, watching somebody, and I'm like, oh, that guy's just a natural. But you're actually aware of what you're doing, but you've gotten so comfortable in accepting who you are that you can do this unconsciously. And that makes you this natural, and you just share and do your thing, and everyone's like, wow, you don't have to even push. It's just because they can tell you know what you're doing.
Yeah. Well, and one downside of it, of being an unpublicist, is that so many people are used to PR or published PR people or companies like being more aggressive. When they meet someone like myself, it's almost like, wait, how can he and his company get this done? Because they don't like hammer on people. So some people are a little bit suspect of that, and I want to speak a little bit more about that later in this conversation if there's time. But and the upside is, which is much bigger than the downside, the upside is that all the right people are completely attracted to the unpublicist, the effortless flow, like the people that know.
That makes sense.
You know, that the best thing you can do is get into the flow versus trying to go upstream. They're totally our people, and we have, you know, great long-term relationships with these folks. And just one example that I wanted to share was that there's a book and film called The Secret that came out in, the DVD came out in March of 2006. And there were all kinds of people who wanted to get their hands on this project in various, you know, professions. And there were a number of publicists who really wanted to work with Rhonda Byrne, the creator of The Secret. And the way that we were hired for that job, I'll try and keep it as brief as I can, was basically this. We were working with the Reno Tahoe Film Festival. Al Gore's film, The Inconvenient Truth, dropped out 10 days before. The film festival needed an opening night film. They said to our team, to me and our team, we know this isn't your area, but if you know anyone that's got a film for opening night, we have an opening. And I immediately called Bob Proctor, one of the experts in The Secret. I said, do you think they might be interested? There's a spot at this film festival. He said, let me get you in touch with the CEO. I called a gentleman named Bob Renone in Chicago, and he said, I think we'd be real interested. Let me get back to you. Within 2 hours, I had a yes. The Secret wanted to come to the film festival. They were just getting a new second version ready. They'd rush a print from their production in Australia. 10 days later, Rhonda Byrne, the creator of The Secret, like a team of about 12 people that were either in the movie or helped on it, met us at Tahoe. It screened. 2 days later, I'm in the lobby of this gorgeous resort in Lake Tahoe. It's summertime, so it's totally green out, big trees, sunshine. I'm in the lobby with Rhonda Byrne and her sister. It was their first break in, I think, a year, you know, in making this film. And the energy around it was just building, building, building. And she looks at me and she says, John, you have a PR company? I said, yes, that's what we do. You know, that we get the message out to media. She's like, you're the one.
Wow.
And she started crying and she fell in my arms.
Oh, man. A double benefit.
And, you know, I'm like, I'm telling you guys, it was totally surreal. And I remember being very present. And I looked outside this, like, 40-foot tall window out into Lake Tahoe, which is like heaven on earth. And I said, okay, God, I got this.
Attracting the right people, that's the key. And that's, it makes everything easier, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And so, so there's a lot of upside. And as I'm sure you both have seen in the world, it can be challenging to find people that you resonate with sometimes. Sometimes it feels like that.
Mm-hmm.
But they are there. They are there. They will find you. You'll find them. You know, it took me 41 years to find Kate Romero, who is my wife and life partner in everything in business. And, you know, it took 41 years, but my gosh, this woman is it. She is my partner. We run through the heavens. So if anything, I want to encourage everyone who's listening that, you know, if all the right people haven't shown up yet, they will. Now they will. They're there. It's just you got to be patient. And you know, when the world is looking the way it is these days, you know, I think it takes even more patience and persistence.
Well, this wraps together with everything we're saying, John, because you know, we talk about the willingness for change. At the same point, willingness for change allows us to be open on how we define things and how you were willing to define yourself and how you could walk out of the barriers of how others were defined. They could see that. And then when you have this willingness for change, you recognize that the way that the world advertises the way that we would like things to be and the way that the world actually works is really different in that, like, you're on your own path. Everyone's on their own schedule. And everyone thinks it's this race where you got to have this right away. And if not, then you're not catching up with somebody. But when the right thing comes along at the right time, everything makes sense. All of a sudden, upon reflection, it's like, ah, that's why everything was needed. And what you were talking about with the flow, one of the things I mentioned to people is life is like a dance. There's an elegant push and pull. And if you push too much, it's like you're in a dance and you're pushing, if you're a man and you're dancing, you're pushing the woman up against the wall. She has nowhere to go.
Right. Yeah.
Or you feel like you get pushed up against the wall. Sometimes that can happen. Right? So when you're in the flow, you just allow the dance to take place and enjoy the scenery as things go along.
It's living in the present moment and letting go. It sounds like what you're both are talking about.
Right, which is easy but challenging.
Yeah.
Well, because no one prepares you for that. There's no way of doing it because most people have their mindset, this is the way it goes, and that's what we get through society. And when you actually start to learn it, which I try to help people understand, and what I try to time gap them with is, this is the way it's going to be, folks. And if you understand it up front, then you could stop fighting it. You can work with it. And when you work with it, then it's way more a better experience. Because, you know, one of the other episodes we did a couple weeks back was, you don't know what you don't know. And your willingness for change really connects with that. Is that you don't know what you don't know, but you're willing to change to find out. And that opens doors that would never open otherwise.
Absolutely. And there's just one thing that popped in my mind that I wanted to share, which it's, I feel like it's another pervasive conversation out there, at least it was that when, I think it's men or women, but for me, the thought that I had before was that you get to 40 and then you start getting fat and your body starts, you know, wearing down.
Only if you believe it.
And there was a part of me that was living into that. And I was heading in that direction. And then when I'm 41, I met Kate Romero, my partner in all things and my champion. Can't say enough about her. She's kind of like, well, who told you that? And, you know, I was believing that story, you know, as much, you know, personal development work as I've done and as much as I, you know, live to be a conscious person, I was in that story. And, you know, I'm 5'11", and I was, you know, pushing towards 200 pounds, which is pushing towards obesity. And when I got in a relationship with Kate, within a few months, I think it was literally within 3 months, I was down to 165 pounds, and which was my high school weight, which was the weight I was at when I was a senior in high school, and which she and I refer to as the size you recognize. So, you know, and I was willing to change there too. I was willing to give up that conversation, and I would see, you know, friends and colleagues of mine, and, you know, they were in this belief that when you're 40, things start to go downhill, and I you know, was speaking with some of them and said, you know, you really don't have to, and a few of them saw my example and have made changes, and others are still in that path. So, you know, maybe if anyone's listening to this and they have this conversation that, you know, I'm going to go downhill and, you know, get fat or whatever, you know, have a heart attack, whatever that conversation is, you know, it's an area where, again, if they're willing to change, they can have it be different.
The power of beliefs, one way or the other, whatever you believe. But the key there is it's so unconscious, it's difficult sometimes, right, to uncover that belief. But it is there.
Yeah,
one of the things that I teach people is this concept called flip it. When you reach a roadblock, you reverse the way you're looking at it, because that might be the roadblock the way you look at it. So how do you look at the opposite way of seeing what the other option is? And you know, at that point, she kind of did a flip it to you. She's like, oh, well, why doesn't it have to be that way? You want to join me?
And you know how it is. At first, your mind is like, what do you mean just flip it? How could I just flip it? You know, it's like your conscious mind just, like, takes over, and it just goes crazy. You know, it's berserk. You know, how can I do this? How is it even possible? And then you just have to, like, use the word flip it. You got to flip it. It's like, okay, look, if I stay on that path, I know where I'm headed. If I flip it and go this other path, I don't know where it's going to wind up, but it's certainly or likely, very much likely, not going to look like the other path. So why don't I try it? It won't cost me anything.
Right. And that's where that whole experience of willingness to change before actually prepared you for that moment. Because one of the things that I've noticed, and I give is this other concept, which all these things are interrelated. It's so amazing that with the willingness for change, it opens up these doors, and you are led to these places if you're willing to take the flow and not fight things, where life will prepare you for the moment that you need to be prepared for. You don't even know you're being prepared for. So that when you're there, you're able to, like, not fight it, relax, take it easy, and just, like, go into that and know that, hey, I've gone through change before. Why not, like, give it a shot? Now, if I understand correctly, I have an interesting experience where I broke my neck. And you had said that Kate had some similar situations as well, so she's familiar with a willingness for change, that's for sure.
Oh, absolutely. I think willing to change is her middle name. She doesn't sit still. and she's, you know, she knows better, you know, and I think better than I, and she's got a lot of faith. And I think faith is an important thing, and not faith in the terms of religion, but faith in the terms of like a universal principle.
Right, and I think that means pretty much one of the concepts I teach people is the real meaning of self-responsibility, and that ultimately parallels with self-faith and the faith that you were here for a reason. So, you know, stop trying to get in your own way and just have faith that you were here and you are here to do what you're supposed to do. And for yourself, I mean, you're an example for what a PR person can be, right?
I think so. You know, I recently heard somebody say, you know, it was a career kind of related comment. It was, you know, if you're in your work of passion, stay in your lane and just keep improving. You know, stay in your lane, just keep bettering yourself, keep upping your game. So, you know, that's one of my mantras these days.
So, John, how big is knowing your purpose in life? Did you consciously try to determine your purpose, or does your purpose sort of naturally come to you as you're open and willing to explore why we're here?
I think it unfolded over time. I certainly Don's story of breaking his C1 vertebrae when he was 10 is an incredible story that I find fascinating. Mine wasn't like that, but when I look back, there were all these clues. Like, one of the clues was that when I was 6, 7, 8 years old growing up in Santa Monica, California, I loved to get into construction sites, homes, condos, usually not the commercial buildings because they were a little tougher to get into, you know, to walk backwards into. But I got into dozens and dozens of homes and condos that were being built at that point. And I loved to go through, especially when these buildings were in the framing stage, and just imagine what was going to be. And this is the point where they would put in the electrical outlets, and there were those metal slugs.
Yeah.
And so, like my souvenirs were that every time I go in a home or a condo building or remodel project, I would collect slugs, and I had a huge jar of slugs. So I had that vision. One of my dreams as a child was to become an architect and a builder. Now, I didn't do that. However, I consider that a big part of my work is helping people build their visions and get them out in the world. So I'm an architect of visions in the work that I do. So that was one of the clues when I look back. It's like, well, of course. You know, I was in these buildings. I was looking around, seeing how things got built. How, you know, like from the ground up, how do you do it? And, you know, and we do that with our clients, you know, nowadays. We see where they're at. We look for ways to help them tell their story and share about the work so that the widest possible audience can hear and then participate with them. So it's, you know, I had clues all along the way, and I've just put them together, and I am blessed that I had that realization in my early 20s, you know, as a reporter and producer, that, you know, what I thought wasn't going to work the way I thought. And so I got to choose, and I chose to, you know, take another path. And I got to see that it worked out. And, you know, I no matter what, I know things worked out. And I just, you know, if I look back, all the clues are there for where I'm at.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly today.
I definitely understand, John. It's that if you have the positive outlook, and I try to actually not even use the word positive or negative or good or bad, a beneficial way of approaching things is that everything always works out in the end. And every day is a good day. Just some days are better than others. And if you put it in a gradient like that, everything isn't like gloom and doom and total, you know, chaos. You just say, hey, you know, I've had better days, but this is still a good day. If it be, think about how you'd be thankful and appreciative for what's going on. And when you're talking about the construction site, it really dovetails with a concept that I say, when you see a building and it's in structure, it's in frame, you know, all things being equal, that it's going to be finished. You're just catching up to the completion. So when you're doing your creativity with a PR work, you're seeing, okay, these are the basics. We're going to get the framework going, and then we're going to build the structure as it happens, and we're going to see it. We see the end where we know where we want to take it. And what's magnificent is sometimes as it grows, it becomes even more than what we dreamed it could be. And that's part of the fun of it. Because you didn't know what they were going, how they were going to design these things while you were working. So you went in 1 week, came back 2 weeks later, and it was, wow, you know, I thought this, and this is what they did with it. You know, that was really a different turn. And so you were able to understand how you can still have a vision, but be willing to change with it. And that's what makes you flexible enough to take your clients where they need to go, correct?
It is, yes. And the folks that are meant to work with us and we with them, you know, that are, the collaboration is supposed to be, are the folks that are most open to that, you know. And with some that we work with, it takes them seeing it. And for others, they've already got the vision. Oh, gosh, it's like a phone comes preloaded with software. You know, it's like some folks we work with, like Don, I find you to be a person who you've already got the everything on your phone, you know, in your mind, and it's just a matter of you firing up the application. So, you know, that's where I can tell that it's a fit. You know, where we've got this room to collaborate, this room for there to be some unknown, because the truth is life is incredibly unknown, and that's one thing about this field of public relations is that there's many more gray areas than black and white. And so it does take that vision. It does take that courage.
I wanted to ask you a question here, just because I want to make sure I get this in before the end of our time, is you call yourself everyone's PR. And most people, if they even understand what a PR is, they have this concept that it's so overwhelming that they wouldn't even want to start. And your approach seems to be way more welcoming and way more believable to connecting to a PR than anything I've ever seen. And I think that's kind of where your concept of being able to share what you do comes off so smoothly. Could you explain, like, the slight little nuances while we have time here, how you're just that little bit of a slight difference? Because I explained to people, you know, an earthquake, you know, the two plates just move a couple of inches and it just creates rumbles throughout everything. And that's the way it is with life. You just have to make these small shifts and all kinds of amazing things happen. So how is it that as a PR guy you make these small little shifts that really make the difference for the average everyday person?
Well, that's a great question. And I think one of the main things is showing the clients that we work with their greatness if they don't fully see it. Because one of the most challenging things ever is promoting yourself. I think it's right next to doing brain surgery on yourself. And it's actually not really a good idea, because it's just there's so much personality and stuff that can get in the way. So I think one of the biggest things we do is we really show people who they are and what they provide. So they can really feel it, and there's more openings for them to be talked about in the media and connect with influencers. And, you know, we're not fueling egos. We're just looking to give people a real dose of what they provide. And what we often find when we always write two documents for people, we write a company story and a news release that any news outlet in North America would know exactly what to do with. And what we often find is that when our clients read these documents, they're like, hey, I sound pretty good, you know, I like me, you know. And so, and it might sound super silly, but I think it's important. It's important for people to know and not have it be a sense of ego, but for them to really feel good, you know, about their work and their purpose, and know that, that there's an extension of them, you know, called Everyone's PR, that's looking out for them and you know, listening and looking for opportunities for them to be seen and heard and known fully in the world. And it is a process. And one of the reasons that we made a big change, we went from a monthly fee basis to a results, a pay-for-results model, was that so we could have budgets go longer. We could have people hang in for a year or two versus maybe 4 or 6 months if they, you know, had X dollars to spend. You know, and that was syncing up with my vision for a collective of great people that we promote who are great on their own, and also there's opportunities for them to connect with other people we work with, and just this, you know, collective of brilliant people and resources and services and programs and products that we're a part of you know, launching and getting out into orbit. Because once people and their companies are in orbit, then there's just a lot more they can do. So I've really gone on, but I hope I answered your question.
Well, that's a great answer. And let me ask you this. John, you say pay for results. Now, the CPA hat has come on my head right now, my business consulting part of me. How does that work? So you pay for results, and I like what you've said so far about this model. Do you set up certain criteria in the beginning, and if the criteria is met, that would be equivalent for paying for results? Or why don't you describe how that works? You have me intrigued on this.
Okay, well, we kept it super simple, and we've simplified it even a bit more. It's this. There's a startup fee of $1,000 that a client will pay. We create two documents. We create a media plan. Basically, we have everything that we write and design during the first, essentially, 3 weeks of working together to go out and attract media attention. We charge a monthly subscription fee of $250, which is a base for having us keep the lights on. And then anything else on top of that is purely based on results. So if we've come up with a story about a client that's going to run in the LA Times, they, once it is in print, they pay us $250. If we get them on a local television station, that's $500. If we get them in a national print publication like Newsweek or Time or People, that's $750. If we get them on a national television show like a Good Day America or We Love ABC News Nightline, that would be $1,500. So it's on our website. It's just very straightforward, and real.
So you're not. I like that because so you're not tying it into like increase in sales or how many people call them. You're getting them exposure, and from that point, it's really they got to take some responsibility to do good on these shows. To, you know, if it's a national print publication, if they're writing articles, that it's a good article. So your job is really to get them into somewhat difficult places, but with high attention value.
That's exactly right. And I just want to add that for 22 years of doing this work, I've always worked with emerging companies and entrepreneurs who, you know, had X dollars to spend or needed to have public relations fees be, you know, make sense to what they were selling. And so we always look at, you know, how is this kind of result going to translate to sales? You know, we know that. We know that our clients need to sell, whether it's videos online, books, DVDs, courses, whatever they have that they're selling. We need to make sure that our work is contributing to that bottom line. You know, otherwise it wouldn't make sense for us to keep collaborating. You know, and that's just a bottom line that we've had in place all the time, I think the pay-for-results model is, we take even more responsibility for that.
That totally makes sense. One other question I have is, from a business standpoint, is do you believe every industry should have a PR firm?
Yes, I do. I do, in the sense of, back to that point about doing brain surgery on yourself, which I would never advise anyone to do. I certainly wouldn't do it. I'm the last to promote myself and our company, and thank goodness I got into a relationship and married a woman who is the most incredible publicist and unpublicist I've ever met. And she's all over Facebook about us, and that's, in fact, that's how we got to know Don and how we're at this phone call. So my wife is responsible for me being here today and for promoting us. So I think that every industry can use that professional perspective, even if they just engaged a company like ours for a short window of time, to have a reality check. I think that would be really healthy of them to do.
Yeah, and John, just to wrap this up, when Kate sent me over the friend request, or you sent me over the friend request, you did not even push or even say anything about your PR work. I just looked into who you were because you wanted to be my friend. I said, wow, you know, this links up really well with what I'm trying to do. And that's how you just naturally put it out there, and what comes to you through that flow and working with what naturally attracts when you're trying to do something, it happens. So that's a perfect example of how this works. And it doesn't need to be complicated. Yeah. You just got to understand sometimes it takes time. And like when you're talking about your progression with everything, you know, people need to start to get to know someone before they can be able to reach their full value out in the community. And having that voice and have people that can speak for you actually says a lot of volume in the social sense, because when a person speaks, it's like, great, without having somebody to be able to relate that value firsthand, there's a disconnect. So you, being in PR work really gives people that ability to connect with people in a way that they can on their own. And that's part of that unique value that you have with the way that you assist them instead of putting any pressure on them.
Well said, Don. Yes, and well, John, you know, can you believe it? An hour has almost gone by. We'd love for you, if you want to give contact information, how people can get in touch with you. I'm certainly interested. You're just magnificent. I love your style, your service to others. And one thing I really love, before we go off the air, I'd love you to comment on this, is that you made I wrote it down, you said you and Kate, you run through the heavens together.
Yes.
I love that phrase. I wrote it down. What does that mean to you? And then give some contact information out.
Sure. Well, it's about partnership, and I'm joined at the hip with Kate, who is my life partner, everything in my life. And she spoke of running through the heavens, and I've adopted that. And that's heaven isn't somewhere beyond us. Heaven's where we live. So, you know, every day I run through heaven with her, experiencing life, and everyone has the opportunity to do that. And, you know, I run through heaven with her in all aspects, including romantically. There are other people in life that I run through heaven with that's not romantic, but, you know, I'm running through this life experience that I consider heaven. Which is where people are self-expressed, and in the context of this conversation, they're willing to change and they're open. So I hope that answers your question.
It absolutely does. It's really beautifully poetic. I really enjoy this. How do they get in touch with you, John?
Best way for them to get in touch, listeners, is our website, which is www.e, like everyone's, hyphen or dash PR.com. So that's www.e-or-pr.com. Best email address is info@e-pr.com. That goes to both Kate and I, and one of us will get back to you within a business day, any questions you have.
Wow, that was excellent. Before you go, John, just Don, give out your contact real quick.
Well, the show's called getontoit.com. The best place to see me is getontoit.com, G-E-T-O-N, the number 2, IT.com. You can see everything as far as the connections for the radio show and upcoming events, teleseminars, and I really appreciate any feedback that I can get, any suggestions or anything that you've heard talked about or want to hear talked about. Please give us a shout. And the last thing is to contact me personally, phone number 216-496-9494. That's 216-496-9494.
And John Steller, thank you so much for being our guest today. We would love to have you on again. You're just a wealth of I was going to say knowledge. It is knowledge, but it's more than that. It's inspiration. We appreciate you.
Have a great day.
Well, thank you so much, gentlemen.
You're more than welcome, John Steller. And we'll see everyone next month. Get on to it, starring Don Williams. Have a great week.